then I think we can start with maintenance and consistent application, first with the IFRIC update.
Start first with paper 12A, if that's okay. That's on the lack of exchangeability.
Okay, that's fine.
Yes, so I'll hand over to Paolo then to kick us off.
Okay.
Okay, thank you. Good morning. Can I go on?
Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. Okay, in April, the board tentatively decided to propose a narrow scope amendment to IAS 21. The proposed amendment will specify how to define exchangeability, and there's a lack of exchangeability, how to determine the spot exchange rate when a currency lacks exchangeability, and disclosure required when a currency lacks exchangeability. Agenda paper 12A discusses transition, early application, and due process for the proposed amendment. I will first introduce the section of the paper discussing transition and early application, which is discussed in paragraphs 9 to 32, and will hand over to you for questions 1, 2, and 3 on page 11. Paragraphs 9 to 22 discuss our analysis and recommendation on transition for entities already applying IFRS standards. For the reasons discussed in paragraph 10, we recommend proposing specific transition requirement for the proposed amendment. Our recommendation, summarized in paragraph 22, considers separately situation in which an entity reports foreign currency transactions in its functional currency and uses a presentation currency other than its functional currency. Now, moving on to first-time adopters, we recommend providing no specific exemption for first-time adopters for the reason discussed in paragraphs 24 and 25. We also considered the interaction of the proposed amendment with requirements in IFRS 1 on severe hyperinflation. For the reasons discussed in paragraph 28, we think a specific exemption is unnecessary in this respect. However, we recommend aligning the wording in paragraph D27 of IFRS 1 with the definition of exchangeability in the proposed amendment. We also recommend permitting an entity to apply the amendment earlier than the effective date. And with that, I'll stop and direct your attention to questions 1, 2, and 3 on page 11, and ask if you agree with our recommendation on transition and early application.
Tadej, you can go ahead.
Thank you, Hans, and thank you, the team, for the paper. I have actually two questions. Paragraph 22B, small one, of this agenda paper suggests that at transition, both the monetary items and non-monetary items measured at fair value use the exchange rate at the date of initial application. But in the end of the day, is the closing rate. It seems that the proposal is not allowing to keep the exchange rate when the fair value, supposing the item that was measured at fair value in a foreign currency, to use the fair value, the exchange rate that was determined when the fair value was determined, as we have today the current text of IAS 21. I mean, I may have done some revaluation, for example. The fair value was determined in 3rd November, and there was, let's suppose, FX rate available at that time. And then I understood from the text of the paper that even if they had this foreign exchange rate available at that date, they should use the closing rate, even if the closing rate doesn't exist, and then you have to apply the guidance we are proposing here. And the second question is, again, in relation to the revaluation. The agenda paper suggests that the entity shall recognize the effect of initially applying the amendments in the opening retained earnings. But if you look at IAS 21, the current text, when we have gain losses on a non-monetary item that is recognized in OCI, any exchange difference shall also be recognized in OCI. Having said that, I'm wondering whether if this is the case, the effect of initial application of the amendment should go to OCI, for example, to revaluation surplus in case the entity has applied the revaluation method.
So maybe I can, maybe if it's helpful, I can answer these two questions if others might also have the same question. So that on your first point, I think you're talking about non-monetary assets measured at, that might be measured at fair value, and they might have been measured at a fair value at a different date, and we are requiring them to use the exchange rate at the date of initial application. Now, when we looked at this, we saw that whenever IFRS standards require or permit an entity to measure items at fair value, that fair value measurement would be done at the reporting date, or even if it's done at a date other than the reporting date, it would not have it. There's a requirement to say that it's not materially different from what it would have been at the reporting date itself. So considering that, we thought for simplicity purposes, it's better if you just require these items to be measured using the exchange rate at the date of initial application, because whenever they were measured, they would not be materially different from the fair value at that date. So that was on the first question. And on your second question of recognizing any effect of initially applying the amendments in opening retained earnings and not asking entities to split it out. So we agree, like you said, there could be some items for which the exchange differences might, IAS 21 might require the exchange differences to go in OCI, but we thought those items were few and infrequent. And to require entities to determine the split for that might introduce unnecessary complexity into the proposal. At this stage, I think we were just trying to focus on how we can, a simple approach to get entities onto the amendments, and this was more, our decision here was more from a cost-benefit perspective to say this is probably the most cost-effective way of getting people onto the amendments at this stage, as opposed to requiring entities to determine the exact split of how much you go to retained earnings versus the cumulative transition difference adjustment.
Okay, thank you. Just in terms of the infrequent, I think that when we get the feedback from the exposure chart, I think that we can confirm that. Okay, thank you.
Absolutely.
Sue?
Thanks, Hans. I had a question about the IFRS 1 proposal. So firstly, I should say that I agree with the staff recommendations, but I just wanted to check one thing on IFRS 1. So in paragraph 24 of the paper, we talk about the fact that you recommend that no specific exemptions needed. And it just struck me that if an entity has to apply these requirements retrospectively, that an IFRS 1 first-time adopter might end up with the same challenge that we talked about in paragraph 15, that you may have an item which is measured at historical cost or that's equity, where the exchange rate that was used in the past wouldn't meet these new requirements, and would they not have that same problem? So I wondered if you could explain to me why we didn't think the same relief was necessary to address that particular issue.
Yeah, I can take a stab at that. So when we looked at this again, I agree with you. I think an entity, a first-time adopter, could have some similar challenges, but this would just be one element of them determining the cost, for example, of a non-monetary asset, for example. And so we would expect this problem to arise mainly in the context of non-monetary assets that are measured at historical cost. And that would be in the case of, for example, your PP&E, intangible assets, right-of-use assets, those type of assets. And for all of those assets, IFRS 1, I think it's paragraph D5 and D7, have a deemed cost exemption, which allow an entity to use the fair value of the deemed cost at the date of transition. So given that exemption already exists, when it's difficult to determine the cost of an item, we thought an entity could just, the same rationale would apply here as well, and that's why we didn't think a separate exemption is needed.
Okay, so there's sort of already inbuilt relief that could be relevant to help them in this situation, so we didn't feel we needed anything incremental.
That's correct, and we can explain that we can draw that out in the basis when we explain it.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Jen Chow.
Thank you, Hans. Generally, I agree with staff's recommendation. I have two questions. The first question is the same as the second question raised by by Dadu about when the entity puts its foreign currency translation in its functional currency, and all the effects of initial applying amendment will go to opening retaining earnings. And I also have similar concern for those items measured at fair value, and at fair value, and the changes in fair value would go to, you know, will go to OCI. It seems that there will be some inconsistency between this requirement and the existing requirements of IAS 22. But so I think it would be helpful, as Jiawei said, that in the basis on conclusion, to try to explain what's the reason behind this proposal and what kind of consideration we consider, and try to seek the feedback from stakeholders. So this is the first one. Second question about for those companies who using, you know, representation currency other than its functional currency, and the existing proposal in paragraph 22C, III, we say that we propose to recommend any effect of initial applying amendment as an adjustment to the accumulated amount of translation differences in equity. In my understanding, this requirement only apply to the situation when the entity's functional currency is not hyperinflational, rather than the functional currency is hyperinflational. So I think it's better to, you know, to particularly mention this point. It's only, you know, applied to that situation when the entity's functional currency is not hyperinflational, because we're using the word "end" in the end of the second paragraph paragraph 22C, and it seems that in order to cause any unnecessary confusion. Another one is that I'm not sure whether it's possible to make it clear what item of equity will be, you know, will be will reflect that effect. From my point of view, it's better to directly mention that is OCI item rather than other item of other or components of equity, for example, retaining earnings or something like that. I think this is the intention behind this proposal. Definitely those effects will go to OCI rather than other item, other component of equity.
Jiawei, do you want to make a comment?
Yeah, no, we can definitely consider clarifying those points that Jinta has raised when we're drafting the amendment. So we'll definitely take them on board if we're drafting the exposure draft. Okay. Thank you.
Excellent. Mary?
Thanks, Hans. David, I think it's wording comments rather than any disagreement. One is, in the context of this paper, everything about transition, for example, paragraph 14, it says when an entity first applies the amendment to 21, thou shalt. And I think, and I'm saying this at the table for anybody who's listening, that we mean first you apply the amendment to see whether or not the foreign currency is exchangeable. And then if it is determined not to be exchangeable, you do this rather than you must override observable rates. And then the second thing is, I have to admit, I've certainly rustier than Tadeo or Jingdao on IS 21. And I was scratching my head in paragraph 14B to try and think about why there would be a cumulative effect versus it all just flowing through as a change in the rate. But of course, as you had pointed out to me, it's a remeasurement between 31st December and 1st January, assuming it's a calendar year-end entity, of foreign currency monetary items and non-monetary items measured at fair value in a foreign currency for which there would be this adjustment. And I think we just need to bring that out so that everybody's clear what are the specific items that we're saying are subject to remeasurement. And so I think those are both drafting points rather than questions of substance.
Okay, Rika.
Thank you, Hans. I agree with staff recommendation on this paper, but just a quick request about first-time adopter. I agree with no incremental exemption is necessary in this connection, but could you please include the reason why we think or we consider that unnecessary in basis?
Yes, absolutely. We will do that when drafting.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. So, Javed, you want to, or Pablo, you want to lead us through the questions for the voting?
Yep, we can do that. I'm just going to. So question one is on transition for entities already applying IFRS standard. Does the board agree with our recommendation in paragraph 22?
Question one.
Mary?
Yes.
Okay, 12.
All right, question two, on first-time adopters, does the board agree with our recommendation not to provide specific exemptions for first-time adopters and to amend paragraph D27B as set out in paragraph 30? And question three, does the board agree with our recommendation to permit early application? Thank you. So I'll hand back to Paolo to walk us through the due process.
Okay. Thank you, Javed. Thank you. Moving on to the due process steps, for the reason discussed in paragraph 34, we recommend a comment period of no less than 120 days for the exposure draft. Appendix A summarizes the required due process steps taken in developing the proposed amendment to IAS 21. Based on our analysis, we think the board has complied with the due process requirements. Questions 4, 5, and 6 on page 11 of the paper ask whether the board agrees with our recommendation to allow a comment period of no less than 120 days for the exposure draft, whether any board member intends to dissent from the publication of the exposure draft, and whether the board is satisfied that it has complied with applicable due process steps and that it should begin the balloting process for the exposure draft. So these are the three questions.
First on the comment period. Who agrees with the comment period for no less than 120 days?
Don't count Mary twice, Neil.
12.
Does anybody wish to comment? No. And finally, give permission to ballot. All right.
12.
Well done, staff. And that leads us to the final point on the agenda for today, which is extractive activity.
Sorry, Hans, yeah. We just have paper 12B, a quick update.
Oh, sorry.
Can I quickly run through that? Sorry.
All right, go ahead.
Yeah. Thank you, everyone. So we will move on to paper 12B, which summarizes the committee's June meeting. The committee published one tentative agenda decision and finalized three agenda decisions. I'll start with the tentative decision, which starts on page 2. The agenda decision discusses reverse factoring arrangements. Now, these are arrangements in which a financial institution agrees to pay amounts an entity owes to the entity supplier, and the entity agrees to pay the financial institution at a date later than when the suppliers are paid. The agenda decision addresses in particular the presentation of liabilities that are part of the reverse factoring arrangements, presentation of related cash flows, and information to disclose in the notes about, for example, liquidity risk that arise in such arrangements. committee members also provided their views on a possible narrow scope standard setting project to develop disclosure requirements for arrangements entered into to fund future payables to suppliers. We will provide the board with a summary of these views at a later date. I will now move on to the final agenda decisions, which start on page six. The first decision relates to a sale and leaseback transaction with variable payments and discusses how a seller lessee accounts for such a transaction at the date of the transaction. Now, as discussed with you previously, this agenda decision relates to your project on sale and leaseback, which will propose amending IFRS 16 to address subsequent accounting for the liability that arises from this transaction. The second agenda decision addresses how an entity accounts for deferred tax related to undistributed earnings inside a subsidiary when tax is payable only on distributions. And the third and final agenda decision addresses whether an entity recognizes player transfer payments received as revenue, applying IFRS 15, or instead recognizes the gain or loss arising from the derecognition of the intangible asset in profit or loss, applying IAS 38. In the fact pattern considered by the committee, the club had already recognized the right that it acquired on bringing the player to the club as an intangible asset, applying IAS 38. So with that, I will stop and ask if you have any questions on the IFRIC update.
Excuse me. Are there any questions? That doesn't seem to be the case. Okay, thank you very much.